Hello, and thank you for joining us. I'm Diana Farnsworth, Project Director for the Anacortes Public Library's NASA at My Library program. Today, I'm going to be interviewing former astronaut and naval captain Wendy Lawrence. Captain Lawrence had a distinguished career in the United States Navy and then became an astronaut in 1992. During her career, Lawrence logged more than 1,225 hours in space on a total of 4 space flights, during which she docked at both the Russian Space Station and the International Space Station. Lawrence retired from NASA in 2006. I have the privilege of talking to her at the Ferndale Library today, where she regularly participates in programs for young scientists. Thank you for taking the time to meet with me today.
You're very welcome.
Getting to bring an astronaut to Anacortes was kind of me shooting for the moon as a library program, so it's an honor.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
As I've been reading about you, I saw that you collaborate with libraries and schools fairly often, and I'm curious what role libraries and books have played in your life.
Well, this library in particular has played a very important role. I will be in here on Thursday afternoon doing a Lego Mindstorms Robotics Club. And it's very fun to introduce the younger kids to the concept of robotics. They've all grown up playing with Legos, so that's something already near and dear to their hearts. But then showing them what it really means to create a robot, that being really nothing more than adding some motors, some sensors, and a computer to integrate all that. And it kind of opens up a whole new world for them and shows them that, hey, a robot will only do what you tell it to do. So learning that skill of being able to tell the robot to do something, that's very important too. Yes, it's fun to build, but that those computer programming skills are very important. And this is a fairly new building, and I think it showed the community that a library is more than just books. It truly is a community resource. This room that we're in is booked throughout the day. People come and go. They use the computers. They're learning skills like Word, doing resumes, especially for people in this area who don't necessarily have computer access at home, internet access. This is truly an invaluable resource for them.
I appreciate you saying that. That is definitely true of the Anacortes Library as well. It's much more than books now. Were you in libraries very often as a child?
Well, you know, back then.
With books?
It's really the only way you got access to books, the easy way to get access to books. And all of my schools had great libraries, the communities that I grew up in as well. My mother taught preschool and actually ran her own preschool on and off for 40-some years, so reading was always a very important thing in our household.
Okay. So did you have a favorite book that you read as a child that inspired you?
Well, one that really stands out, it's a classic, A Wrinkle in Time. I should go back and read it again. It's fun working with some, I also volunteer up at the middle school and do a girls' robotics club there, and most of those girls have all read it, and of course they read it more recently than I have, so probably should go back and reread it so we can have a good conversation about it.
Yes, it's on my list to reread again as well. There's a new graphic novel that I've been hearing about at the library, so I need to reread it and then read that one. I was thinking about being in space, which is something I will only be imagining, and I wondered, I know you don't get a lot of time when you're up there, but I wondered if you had ever read a book or a portion of a book at some point while you were up there.
You don't get a lot of time, particularly on the space shuttle missions, and that's what I flew on. It is pretty much a sprint from the moment you get into space until the moment you burn your engines to leave, and so free time is not something you have a lot of. So, and we're very, very limited on what we can take with us, so books really weren't much of an option for us. It's a different situation for the space station crews, since they're truly living in space. So many of the crews do take books up with them, and now, you know, there's so much they can do with the computers. A lot of them do audio books or download books to have on their tablets so they can read them over the course. That gives them obviously an opportunity to have many, many more books than us having to physically send them paper books. But yes, I know many of a crew member who has wanted to take a book with them in space.
Right. I was just curious, what book would make it up there if you could?
Well, I think probably recently The Martian was a big hit.
Yeah.
You know, and actually the crews watch movies as well, so that's kind of what they do to relax over the weekend. So,
well, that's
if there's a popular book and made into movie form, chances are a crew up there has watched it.
Got it. Well, that's a perfect tie-in to my next question, knowing that you've read Hidden Figures. You're going to be speaking in Anacortes as part of Skagit Reads, and this year we're reading Hidden Figures by Margot Lee Shetterly, which tells the story of some of the African-American women who were integral in helping America get astronauts into space. And I'm wondering what went through your mind when you were reading that story.
I have to tell you a conversation that I had with a fellow astronaut, Ellen Baker, and we both had read the book. This was probably a year ago, January. And she looked at me and said, how come when we were astronaut candidates, we weren't told this history? We should have known this. And I said, Ellen, you're absolutely right. We should have known about these women. Certainly people at Langley Space Center knew their contribution, and I think it's unfortunate that outside of that, collective knowledge had not been passed on to the rest of us working at NASA. So I'm glad she told the story. What those women did, and it wasn't just their ability to do computations, but to challenge some of the barriers that were in front of them. They're tremendous role models, no matter where you come from, where you're growing up, what it is you want to aspire to. These women are tremendous role models.
Yeah, I was certainly inspired by their story. You said that you knew you wanted to be an astronaut when you were 10 years old, seeing the moon landing, and I was curious if there were any fictional stories that inspired you as much as that real life story, any science fiction that helped you in your dreams.
Well, you have to consider my age. I grew up during the era of the original Star Trek.
Okay.
And I am confident my older brother and I have seen all of the original episodes. All so right. That in addition to the actual space flights that were going on, kind of that their version of space flight so many centuries in the future was captivating.
Yeah.
And we wanted to be a part of something like that. So that was just as inspiring to me as actually watching the Apollo 11 guys land on the moon and the subsequent Apollo crews.
Wow. That's high praise for a story. Switching gears a little bit, recently the idea of STEM, which you spend a lot of time working with young girls on, has been expanded to include art, so it gets called renamed STEAM. And I actually first heard about you, that you live nearby, and I might have a chance to meet you, from a local artist, Rick Allen.
Oh, yes.
He's a glass artist in town. And his work is inspired by what you do. And I was curious what role you find that art plays in advancing science.
I think they go hand in hand. And I think when you're working with young kids, this is my mother, I'm channeling my mother here. And again, the nursery school teacher who, you know, when you're teaching kids a new concept, she would think about how many different senses can I use?
Yeah.
I'm teaching them the color red. All right, well, we can paint with it so they can touch it, they can see it. I could have strawberries for snacks so they could smell it and taste it. And so she's trying to get all those different senses to work together to really solidify that concept. And I don't think it's any different when it comes to teaching kids math and science and as a result of that, engineering, which is using math and science, and then technology, which comes from our knowledge of math and science and engineering. So if you can approach a kid and have them learn about things because they want to draw a picture of the solar system or draw a picture of a rocket ship, if that helps them better understand some of the things that you're talking about, I'm all for that. It's whatever it takes to get the kids interested and keep them interested. I mean, so many kids that I work with, they're just intimidated by math.
Yeah.
And their first thought is, well, I'm not going to be good at it. Well, why? Well, it was hard the first time I tried. I'm like, well, know, are you a good artist or do you have to practice it? Do you have to learn how to draw? You typically practice those things. So it's really no different when it comes to math and science and learning those concepts. It requires practice. So if you can teach that thought to them, instill that concept in them, that being good at something requires practice, and you can demonstrate that through their drawing abilities and how they have to practice to get better, or painting abilities, or whatever it is with art, I'm all for that.
Yeah. So as one of the few women who's been to space, you're an inspiration to girls and women everywhere. And you mentioned your mother, but I'm wondering who the important women in your life were and how they inspired you.
Well, certainly my mother. You know, thinking back, I grew up in an era where there weren't a tremendous number of female role models. Most of them probably were in the sporting world, like Billie Jean King. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to seeing the movie that's coming out about her and Bobby Riggs. Margaret Court comes to mind as well. Mm-hmm. Those were the women who often were featured on television, or you could read about in the newspaper. Not so much women who were making contributions in the field of science. And so I kind of go back to Star Trek, Lieutenant Uhura. You know, seeing women on the bridge of the Enterprise, it's like, oh, look, women can go do those things. Once I got to college, obviously Sally Ride being the first American woman in space, look, yes, women can go do these things. So unfortunately for me, there weren't a lot of women that I could go look at and say, oh, all right, you're doing what I want to do. Because when I decided I wanted to be an astronaut, there weren't any women doing that yet.
I'm really glad that you decided to do it anyway.
Me too, because it was a fun job.
Many young people are actually told to now pursue a practical career, to do something that's a sure thing. And as someone who went after a very unconventional job, when it was even less likely to happen, what do you have to say to kids who are trying to decide between something that seems like it'll be a sure thing and stable versus taking a risk on something?
You have to have a plan.
Yeah.
So if you look at the way I approached it, I got some very wise advice from my dad, which was go look at what the first groups of astronauts did in their careers before they got selected by NASA to be an astronaut. Okay. And try and follow in their footsteps. And so I laid out a path that was a series of steps that I felt I needed to put together in order to get to where I wanted to go. So get high enough grades in high school that I could get accepted to a college.
Yeah.
Go to that college and study engineering. Probably should learn how to fly. Well, I grew up in a Navy family. My mother's father went to Naval Academy, naval aviator, was stationed at NAS Whidbey Island, and probably was amongst the very first group of people in the Navy to be at that base, because he was there in 1943.
Wow.
He used to use Mount Baker as one of his navigation aids. My dad went to Naval Academy, was a naval aviator, so that was in the family blood, and I decided, okay, I'm going to go to the Naval Academy. Need to study engineering. I did that as well. Another check. I want to become a pilot. Most of the astronauts were pilots. I did that, got a chance to go to flight school, got qualified as a naval aviator. I knew somewhere along the way I needed to get a master's degree. The Navy gave me an opportunity to do that. So I looked at it and said, if this is where I want to end up, what path gives me, for my personality, what path will give me the highest chance of success? And so I laid that out. So that's what I would say to kids is, okay, if you want to end up here, how are you going to get there? Because it just doesn't fall in your lap. Making your dream come true is hard. It requires a sustained effort. For me, 25 years.
Yeah.
And you've got to figure out what you need to do to get from point A to point B, because somebody's just not going to pick you up and move you there.
Right.
You're going to have to do that work, and you're going to have to navigate that path. So that's what I encourage them to do. It's like, don't be afraid of taking risks. You need to do that in whatever you do in life. And also don't be afraid of having some setbacks and having some failures. Because like I said, making that dream come true, that is a hard path. It's an up and down path. Sometimes you have to do some diversions. It's not necessarily going to be straight, but you have to be prepared for that. And if you can't figure out a path to get you to that ideal job or that, you know, that big dream job that you want to have, then maybe it's not time for you to pursue it yet. Maybe you need to go down to another path until you can figure out a path that will get you to that other job that you want to have. So I don't want to discourage anybody, particularly since I'm a big proponent of the power of a dream, but I do want kids to understand that it just doesn't happen. They've got to make it happen.
Right. Well, before you became an astronaut, you studied ocean engineering, and I'd like to know how studying the ocean prepared you to work in space.
Okay, so back to talking about kids and making dreams come true.
Yes.
And how certain things are going to be hard. I also tell kids, like, look, do not sell yourself short. Before you undertake something, don't look at it and decide, oh, I'm not going to be good at it. You don't know until you try. So here's the story I tell them. I got to the Naval Academy my first summer, and many of the midshipmen who were in charge of the company that I was in were studying aeronautical engineering. And all of the 3 weeks that they were in charge of me, 3 or 4 weeks, whatever it was, I just listened to them complain about how hard their senior year was going to be and how much homework they were going to have to do and how hard the tests were going to be and how they weren't going to have any free time as an aeronautical engineer because they were going to have to study all the time. And on and on and on they went. And when it came time for us our first semester in the academic year to decide on our majors, I thought to myself, well, I'm not going to be smart enough to be an aeronautical engineer. I know I probably should study that, and that will increase my chances of being selected by NASA to be an astronaut. Mm-hmm. I later found out that that's actually not true. NASA looks for a variety of academic backgrounds. But at that moment in time, I said, oh, I'm not going to be smart enough. I'm just not going to be smart enough. But my dad said I really should study engineering. So my thought process wasn't any more complicated than this. Well, growing up in a Navy family, we were always by the ocean, so I like the oceans. I mean, they're very interesting to me, and there's this thing called ocean engineering. So, okay, well, I like oceans, and I know I need to study engineering. That sounds good. I'll just put those two together. Well, engineering is engineering. Ocean engineering is very similar to mechanical engineering in many ways, a little bit of civil engineering in the ocean environment. So you learn all the basic engineering principles just like you would if you were studying aeronautical engineering or mechanical engineering. Mm-hmm. And it was a good, rigorous education at the Naval Academy, a good, rigorous engineering education as well, and that's what NASA recognized. So I don't think the particular subject matter was that important. It was more that, yes, you have a degree in engineering.
You knew your path. Mm-hmm. So I was reading that NASA prepares their astronauts for every conceivable scenario, and I heard an interview recently of astronaut Chris Hadfield, and he was summing up the training process, and he just described it as being prepared for what's the next thing that will kill me, and I'm curious how that description strikes you.
Well, Chris and I were in the same astronaut candidate class.
Okay.
So it's always fun to listen to Chris give interviews. He's an eloquent guy and a really great guy as well. And there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, one of the things that anybody who's flying in space worries about is what's that unknown?
Yeah.
What's that thing that I really don't really understand, or the thing that I'm not smart enough to think about because I, again, don't truly understand the environment that I have to fly in? So those are the things that you spend long hours thinking about. What's that thing out there that if we can't figure it out and start paying attention to, that could really hurt us? And flying successfully in space, driving a race car, you know, for that matter, building a roller coaster at an amusement park, you're always thinking about the risks associated with it.
Right.
Asking a simple question, what could go wrong? If this thing fails, this piece of equipment, or I have this situation occur, what could be the result?
Mm-hmm.
What would the consequences be? How bad would the consequences be? And then what can I do to keep this from happening, or at least reduce the chance of it happening. And mm-hmm. so that's really what spaceflight is built upon, is what we call this risk assessment and risk management process. So identifying those risks, coming up with a plan of attack, and then training people on that plan. So honestly, when you train for spaceflight, you spend most of your time training for those situations. Okay, in case this happens, where this piece of equipment fails, what are we going to do? And then you get into your mission and you go, wow, nothing's breaking. It's almost boring, you know? I'm so prepared for all these other things when they're not happening. And that's just a testimony to the skill of the people who are involved in the program, their dedication, their diligence to make sure the equipment is well designed, prepared for the flight, you know, that we practice all those procedures and then we just go up and execute the plan.
So has that changed the way you view life on Earth, just everyday things that people view as emergencies? Or
well, not necessarily, because that's what we did in the world of naval aviation as well. Mm-hmm. And Chris would say that also as a Canadian pilot, because he was in the Canadian Air Force. And it's really NASA took that approach from the world of aviation, the world of test pilots. The first class of astronauts, they were all test pilots. Mm-hmm. And so they'd learned the hard way that this is the sort of approach that you need to have. And so has it changed my view? No, I was already thinking that way because I was trained to think that way when I went through my training flow as a naval aviator.
Sure. Has there been anything that after you saw Earth from space that has you really feel like it's changed you in some way, having been up there?
I think we, all astronauts, all space flyers, we tend to have a similar answer. It's really hard to capture in words what it's like to look out the window and see your home planet. Obviously, it's a pretty emotional moment, huge impact as well. And yes, it does change your perspective on a great many things. I mean, we see the world from a very different vantage point. We're up usually about 250-some miles above the Earth's surface, high enough that you can see a bit of its curvature. But you see in the daylight part of the orbit, you see the Earth against this very intense, deep, black void of space because the sunlight just overwhelms the light of all the stars that are there. You just can't see that starlight. And it makes the Earth look small, and in a way it makes it look very, very fragile. So we all come back with a heightened sense of an awareness of how important it is for us to take care of our home planet, since this is the only place that we know how to live on right now. Yeah. We see the continents in a different way as well. There aren't any, for the most part, there aren't obvious borders between countries. Mm-hmm. Nighttime, if you're flying over North Korea, it's pretty easy to spot North Korea because there are hardly any lights. You have South Korea, which you see all the lights from the big cities. That's just not the case with North Korea. That's the one obvious situation. But for the most part, one country rolls into the next. And so we just see planet Earth, where all of us reside. And we just feel like this is what we all have in common. We are all inhabitants of spaceship Earth. So why can't we see that first and foremost and see this thing that we have in common? Why is it that we get sidetracked by focusing on these things that we perceive to be our differences? And so I think that, for me, more than anything, is the perspective that chain has changed. Is we are all citizens of spaceship Earth, of planet Earth. Let us focus on that and these other things that we perceive to be differences. They're just not as important.
It's very well said. I appreciate that. What was the most unexpected thing that happened to you in your life as a consequence of you becoming an astronaut?
Oh my gosh. When you first get to the Johnson Space Center and people start sending you fan mail and asking for your autograph, you're like, really? But I haven't done anything yet. You know, I'm an astronaut candidate. I haven't even flown in space, and yet you want my autograph. So I think I wasn't necessarily prepared for all that attention, having people wanting me to come out and do appearances and presentations and talks, treating you a little bit like a rock star. Yeah, that was It took a little bit of getting used to.
Yeah, I can't imagine.